hello and welcome to Dancing in the Discomfort Zone podcast. My name is Anne Bonny. I'm your host. I'm the one who made this thing happen. So if you're listening, you're welcome. And this is the kind of episode that I started this podcast for. So sometimes I do my content and that's really fun. And I talk about things that I talk about as a speaker and as a workshop facilitator. Sometimes I talk to people who are experts in certain areas of, like menopause and somebody who's experienced getting out of jail and bringing themselves back from addiction. Sometimes I talk, but sometimes I invite people on and we talk about all kinds of uncomfortable things. And the discomfort comes from sitting in the concepts and sitting in the discomfort of not specific topics, but just in discomfort. Today, I'm welcoming Jess Pettit. She is one of those people whose brain, she is so smart, and she is willing to go down the road of uncomfortable things and really think about them and dissect them. And that's what we do in this episode. So, trigger warning, this is not light stuff that we're going to talk about. And it really makes you think. It makes you sit in the discomfort of a perspective because you look at different perspectives. She specializes in diversity and inclusion, in having tough conversations. And so she's willing to and able to put these things into words in a way that really makes you think about them. So as we go through this episode, we're talking about charged political topics, but listen without the emotion. Really try to listen intellectually and follow us down the rabbit holes that we go down. This is a fascinating episode that will make you think and challenge any black and white views that you have, because the world lives in gray areas. And if we are all going to coexist better, we need to be able to allow things that seem on opposite ends of a perspective spectrum. We need to allow those things to coexist together because they do. There aren't any easy answers. And that's what we talk about in this episode. So I'm going to shut up and let you enjoy these deep topics along with all of the delicious food references.
How am I going to get a 30-pound possum out of my bedroom? On Christmas Eve, by the way, P.S. By myself.
Speaking of dancing in the discomfort zone,
excellent intro.
Discomfort Zone today with Jess Pettit, speaker, diversity master, how's that? And cheese lover, and of course, Leo's mom. How are you doing, Jess?
I am doing fantastic. I don't know about master, but I dabble in diversity a lot. That's true. True.
Well, and you dabble in discomfort, basically, and this is what I love. And the whole point of this podcast is getting comfortable, being uncomfortable so we can face the things we need to face and do the things we need to do.
Absolutely. But what I think is so funny about those of us that are quote unquote thought leaders, yuck, is we all speak on the thing that we don't understand the most. And so like our discomfort around the topic has led us to do such a deep dive into the topic that we know a lot about the topic because we are obsessed with how uncomfortable we are about said topic. And that's why we talk about it. But we don't have answers.
Right. But we talk about it more than other people. So,
and we're comfortable being outrageously uncomfortable.
Right. Now, how did you get into this? How did you get into this topic?
There's kind of like three things that happened at once, because that's how it works, right? So, number one, I am too fast, too smart for my classmates. And I'm assuming I must have been a hellish child to raise. So I had very, very smart parents. Everybody is highly educated. Everybody has PhDs. I'm surrounded by books and dissertations my whole life. And I was, God knows how annoying I must have been as a child. So I was like encouraged to do research. And I'd ask a question and the response was, let's go to the library.
Yeah.
And so most of the questions I would ask about uncovered some kind of underdog. Now I would call it a system of oppression, because I seemed as a very, very young person, I seemed very capable of seeing hypocritical patterns. And not consistent patterns, I would only notice the hypocritical part. Now, this could be deeply rooted in my OCD as well, is that one of these things is not like another. That tile is crooked, whatever, whatever. Like, I also live in that place. But hypocrisy didn't make any sense to me. That people could just say it straight face, right? Like, whatever. I would also add, my parents being very, very educated, my mother was a school teacher in the same district I was in. She was also on the school board. So there was probably equal amounts untouchable, and I could get away with anything, and deeper scrutiny with higher expectations because of that reality. And so when, for example, in sixth grade, this is a very long answer, which you're not supposed to do on a podcast, but here I am.
Hey, welcome to it.
Yeah. In sixth grade was our first research paper. Well, I've been doing research papers forever. And we were supposed to do something controversial. The assignment was to do something controversial. So I grew up in Texas. So I decided to do on the history of sodomy laws, as one does.
Wow.
yeah. And I mean, it was controversial, and they'd already taken like eugenics and, you know, euthanasia. So let's go to sodomy laws. Anyway, so I did a like deep dive archival research on why straight people can determine what happens in other people's private life while also protecting their own private life. Yeah, that's to the beginning.
At 11.
I'm young. I went to school early because I was driving my parents crazy. So I was probably 9.
Oh, okay.
You know, as one does. Anyway, and I wasn't wrong. You couldn't not say anything, but like, that's where it started, right? And so I just became more and more aware that I had, now I'm using these words. I did not know these words then, right? But mm-hmm. I was so aware that I had so much access to stuff that other people didn't. And there were people who had access to stuff I didn't. And that seemed crazy pants to me. And I just leaned into it, right? And, you know, as a really privileged person, I kind of bumbled. I don't know if we can cuss on this podcast or not, but I kind of bumbled, I'll say, my way into different kinds of jobs that were around what I had access to and who doesn't have access to what I have access to. And I kept pointing out hypocritical patterns. I kept getting fired. After the third time of getting fired, I started my own business. And now here we are almost 20 years later.
Wow. So hypocritical patterns, what were you, I mean, I'm tempted to say, what are you seeing now?
Ooh, sit down. So let's take something, you know, less controversial than sodomy laws. That's your trigger warning, snowflakes. what makes a war criminal?
Ooh.
Right? You know, these are light questions I like to bounce around in my head.
I mean, just watched Oppenheimer last night, right? Me.
Yeah. So the only people that usually get qualified as war criminals have the least social capital in the world.
Mm.
And being called a war criminal when you're that unpopular and you have that little power doesn't really matter. So war criminal has a lot of teeth in it, but it's only wielded when it kind of doesn't matter. And so the consistent pattern of who actually is tried and imprisoned or executed, depending on what country you're in, are countries that no longer exist, or countries that are primarily people of color. So they don't seem to matter anyway. They don't have a very high GDP. P.S. When I say they don't matter, that is obviously sarcasm, except is it? Anyway, those are the people who get charged with war crimes. So if we actually start looking at like first world countries, which is a problematic term, and the behavior of the leaders of those countries that have done something by definition that would deem them a war criminal, you would have every U.S. president is a war criminal. The vast majority of any one country in the U.N., probably a war criminal. So then if too many people are war criminals, the definition of war criminal no longer has a meaning unless we wield it where it doesn't matter.
Mm.
Boy, it's a little light subject. Mm.
So yeah. Tough Conversations is kind of where you base your business.
Somewhere in the back of your mind is like, I thought this was going to be a really good podcast interview. Anyway, I really like spreadable cheese. Is that, should we start
what
there?
I was getting myself into here.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. I've been awake for a while.
Tough Conversations in the workplace, what we need to get better at. And of course, figuring out the warm criminal situation and sodomy laws. So Tough Conversations, I think one of the biggest challenges of approaching diversity, approaching tough conversations, is that everybody gets so uncomfortable. How do you approach that as the person who's hired to come in and fix the stuff?
Well, what's interesting, so I mean, even in light of how this interview has been going, which again, you probably regret and will probably never air, when I do keynotes or workshops, I actually believe that people would rather have conversations about the topics that I've already brought up than to talk about why they don't talk to their kid.
Yeah.
Or what they are most scared in the middle of the night of their partner finding out about them. Right? Like the intellectual discomfort. And for the record, obviously these topics physically, emotionally, spiritually impact real people, but most of the people talking about them are outside of that.
They're not in my house. But, yeah.
Right. These quote heavy topics are practice ground for the real uncomfortable conversations you need to be having. Mm-hmm. So oddly, and I feel like this does not make sense, and it's why I love my job so much, is that I use the buzzwords of like racism, sexism, ageism, ableism, homophobia, transphobia, general hate, right? Hate, ignorance. I use those as the Trojan horses to actually get to what is actually making us uncomfortable. Because we have the skills to have these really challenging conversations in the Jeopardy columns labeled, this is a hard conversation. But then we opt out of using the skills that we use regularly in situations that are actually uncomfortable for us.
Mm.
And my whole shtick is that we're responsible for the choice of when we use them and when we don't use them.
Use the skills.
Right. We have an arsenal that enables us to have outrageously uncomfortable conversations where it has gone off the rails. It is AWOL. We have no idea where this is going, but I care enough about you to have this conversation. You may be feeling this right now. Again, as the podcast host, we don't know where this is going, but let's hang in there. Let's see where it goes.
I love it. Bring it.
There's trust. There's faith. There's like, all right, let's do it. Right? Like you bring your baseball gear. I'll bring my pickleball gear. Let's see what we can figure out. And then one thing happens and we don't know what to do. We passive aggressively unfollow someone. We just hope the subject never comes up. We pretend, I think holidays are a really great metaphor for all of the minutes you just spent pretending everything is fine. You're the same person. What happened to the pickleball skills that you had? You didn't even employ your pickleball skills. What's going on? But we make those choices and it is centered at discomfort.
Mm-hmm. So what's the secret? How do we overcome that moment of hesitation, that wall that kind of comes up in front of us like, oh, not going there?
Yeah, I would back up a step. I'd give yourself some grace, and instead of aiming for overcoming it, recognizing you're doing it, step one, consciously choosing to or not to employ the skills that you have, right? So like recognition, responsibility, when do you need to do this out of self-care? And when do you need to avoid this because you're being lazy? And I don't use the word lazy very often, but like, if you've ever driven like a manual car, you are in charge of the clutch. Like that's how driving a manual car works. And each car is different and it takes a certain amount of finesse and where you are as a driver, right? There are times where I can drive and like be eating a hamburger and changing the radio. Not that I would ever text and drive at the same time and change gears. and I'm totally fine. And there's other times where I have to turn the radio down to be able to see better, right? Like, it just depends on who and where I am. So can we become more conscious of what we are unconscious of? And if that becomes a habit, there is a possibility we might get a little better about it. And a little better about it eventually, probably after we die, we will have overcome it.
Well, I think this little bit better is so important. I mean, we expect to walk out of a workshop on having difficult conversations and be really, really good at it, which it doesn't happen. You know, it's that first moment of recognition and saying, oh, look at what I just did. I just passive aggressively unfollowed them. And now I'm, you know, like, oh, and it's that recognition. Okay, cool. I just took a little step. And then next time it's maybe, you know, saying, doing something differently, and little by little, we get better and better. And I love that because it's not giant leaps.
Yeah. Well, what I love about your approach to the topic as well is that giant leaps are intimidating. And there's a difference between like stretching out of your comfort zone and giant leaps. And If I break it down to like little morsels, then I'm aiming for a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I'm far more likely to hang in there.
Right. And eventually and you just do it, have a big leap.
Do it again. Do it again. Do it again. And I would even say, if you look backwards on things that you have done that at the time felt like a big leap, now don't seem like that big a deal at all.
Right.
And Maybe it's because of the comparison, or maybe it's because you learned something from it and you brought that into the next session. That's getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. It's not eradicating discomfort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Well, and that's the other piece that I think is so important is, you know, when people say, you know, be fearless. Well, that's a bunch of baloney. If you're fearless, you're not paying attention. You're going to be terrified and you're going to do it anyway. You're going to be uncomfortable and you're going to do it anyway. Like, we're not waiting for it to be comfortable because it's not going to be, period.
Right. Baloney is a great example. That is, who knows what ingredients are inside bologna. We don't need to think about that. Have you had a fried bologna sandwich? Yum. So good. So good. I love me a bologna sandwich, but I don't want to think about it, because if I think about it, I will never eat a bologna sandwich again.
Yeah, and you're 100% right. I love it. Now, one of the things that I think fits into this getting comfortable being uncomfortable thing is something you said a little earlier, where you said, I'm going to say something and it doesn't make sense. And it's true. And this is a concept that I've been playing with lately, is the and. Some things that don't seem to go together totally can coexist. And when we recognize that, it allows us to, again, have that moment of recognition, take one little step forward.
Yeah, the coexisting thing is such a great example of like where my little sweet spot is, right? So like, people are driving around with their vegetable oil powered Subarus with a coexist bumper sticker on them.
She lives in Northern California, y'all. Go ahead.
Very, very Northern California, where we didn't have internet for an hour today because it was raining. Anyway, coexisting is not a goal. Coexisting is occurring. We are currently coexisting. If you have to make a proclamation that you are aiming to exist currently, you're late. Catch up. We are coexisting poorly. So the bumper sticker needs a little caveat, right? Is that to coexist better, that might be better, but that's two words and it gets people off center. And what religious symbols are you going to make the words better out of? Anyway, coexisting is like functioning on an airplane. We are all trapped on this tube. And even now, there's videos, you know, TikToks or whatever, kicking people off of airplanes. So we are policing our coexistence on a regular, while also trying to invite people to recognize they are coexisting. What more of an and is there?
Mm-hmm.
Then if you're conscious of the space that you're in, I'm going to police who can be here. And I'm going to judge who doesn't think they are here or who I don't think should be here, while also I'm going to have a goal. I'm going to aspire to exist with other people. Look around. I'm so confused. But those two things have to almost work together in order to keep an invitation open for anyone where they are entering their own sense of discomfort. You if you got rid of one, you wouldn't be acknowledging the fact that there's a level of discomfort other people are experiencing. And to coexist, I'm using air quotes, I need to constantly be inviting people here. So can I use another example?
If it has to do with sandwich meats, yes, absolutely.
No sandwich meats this time. I don't know. We'll see where it goes. I'm going to take on my pink Okami liberal friends for a second. So if you identify as one of these people, you've been like half listening because you already know everything anyway. Yeah, you. I'm going to talk to you for a second. A step beyond coexisting is providing a space for everyone, or inclusion, including everyone. I want to nudge on that for a second, because including everyone means including everyone. If you're shooting for inclusion, that means no one gets voted off the island. Most of us mean inclusion for the people we like.
Or doing things the way we want them to do them.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Or maybe even, you know, aspirational people that we want to be like them. Okay, mm-hmm. Great. It kind of, you know, both sides, like bookends. So I was recently working with, I think they use the word coalition. Did I roll my eyes in Gen X? I just sure just did. A coalition on abolishment of the industrial prison complex. Great. Let's talk about this. Okay. You know, again, me with the light, fluffy subjects. So, you know, we're having this conversation and I was like, okay, first, I think in order to do this, we need to talk about who we're excluding, like from society, if we get rid of it. And they're like, oh, we're not excluding anyone. I was like, oh, I'm going to put a pin in that one and you're going to have to prove that that is an accurate statement. So what I want to do is take anyone who is currently in prison wrongly. They should not be in prison. Now, what does that mean? Who is that? Or does that include, they're technically in their right, but we just disagree with the laws? Are they actually innocent and they are imprisoned? Sure. Let's just take out people who metaphorically are in prison wrongly. So then the only people that are left in prison are in prison rightly. Okay, whatever that means. Of the people who are rightly in prison, in order for you to abolish the industrial prison complex, all of those people are going where? And then they started in on the not my backyard, which is what people who support prisons also do not want one in their backyard. So now they're saying the same thing. So I was like, no, I mean like words that we use as society, like dangerous, violent, sociopath,
mm-hmm.
would live in your neighborhood. Spoiler alert, they already do. But anyway, if you're holding your community responsible for each other in a collective way, then that collective would allow ourselves to, watch this, you ready? Coexist, learn from one another, teach one another, and hold each other accountable. How we would do that has yet to be determined, which is how we ended up with the systems that we are at. Hashtag baloney, right? So can you imagine the world where you are being held collectively responsible and you are holding yourself collectively responsible for everybody in this world? If yes, then let's build out what's your strategic plan for this. If no, then we have pre-work to do.
Mm-hmm.
And back to that's being comfortable with what's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows the right way to do this. And what ends up happening is everybody kind of like scatters like cockroaches into some reason or some other issue that needs to happen because they're more comfortable there. Mm-hmm. Instead of sitting with this topic, they're going to start talking about stuff in baloney that is now biologically changing our brain patterns and leading to more sociopaths. Okay. And as long as that's existing, you're trying, like, can mm-hmm. we get back to the topic? Yeah, I know that, again, very short answer, Jessica, but I bring that because I think what's important is if we're talking about ideals, we need to really grapple with how uncomfortable we would actually be if that ideal that we say we want would actually happen, because then we can get uncomfortable, or we can get comfortable with that discomfort and fight for it anyway.
Mm.
If we can do that, now we're on to something.
Now we're talking. Well, and it's the same thing with the abortion conversation. Is we're not looking at foster care. We're not looking at child protective services. We're not looking at what happens if all those humans get into the system.
Right. I mean, it's fascinating to me that and talking about abortion, right, is that there is some arguments coming out now that I'm noticing. Obviously, the abortion arguments have been around my entire lifetime. But now there are people talking about how we give human rights to a fetus, but the second the child is born, the rights decrease. There's some other information that once the child is born, what racial identification have we given that person? What gender identification have we given that person? What economic class? Was the person conceived? Now we're even backwards. Was the person conceived through rape or incest or something else? Right? Like, wow, there is a lot of hair splitting happening. When ultimately what we're talking about is the value of life. And at the root of it all, can we just admit that we do not have a consistent, equitable application of value of life? Ooh, you're not supposed to say that, Jessica. Okay. Well, I did. So now can we have that conversation, right? Because then if we start getting that conversation, why is it that we have to go to rape and incest to talk about how a baby was conceived in order to value or not value the fetus, in order to value or not value a baby, in order to value or not value a young person, in order to value or not value an adult?
Well, and this is my whole challenge with people with extreme views, right or left, it doesn't matter. So much of the view is emotional that when you start getting into the technicalities like we are right now, because you and I have not shared at all where we are, right or left, on any of these beliefs. We're just going down this, like, you know, the mental exercise of, mm-hmm. Okay, let's play this out. And so many people's strong opinions are so emotionally driven on one bit that as soon as you start walking down the path, they throw their hands up and they'll walk out of the room.
Right. And
because we don't want to think about it because it's ugly and it's not, you know, I mean, like, it's.
But now we're back to, when do you walk out of the room and when are you like, oh, we're just getting good. Can we get more appetizers? There is an ongoing food theme that should be in the show notes. There are people and there are topics that I will not scurry away from. I lean into.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people and topics that I have zero interest in talking to this. I'm done. I'm full. Sometimes it's by day. Sometimes it's by person. Sometimes it's by topic. I'm in charge of that. And am I being a douchebag or is this like a self-care day? Not today. I can't talk about this today.
Mm-hmm.
That's allowed. I'm responsible for it.
Well, and you're being intentional about it too. You're not saying, I'm not touching that because I'm uncomfortable and I'm hiding in my head in the sand. You're saying, today's not the day that I approach that subject. I understand that I am putting up a wall and not doing it, and I'm doing it on purpose, and here we go.
And I'm going to even be a little graceful to myself. Some days, it takes me days to figure out what happened. But the overcoming skill is sitting with, now, why did I do that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Nobody else's homework assignment for that. Part of the reason my partner and I are like ridiculously, dangerously good for each other is Lauren is a philosophy professor. And I, back to kind of abortion, et cetera, is the argument where I kept getting stuck, specifically talking to liberal and progressive people, which is interesting because my audiences are usually more conservative, but somebody's got to talk to these liberally people, and it might as well be me because they've invited me to the table because I don't know anyone more progressive than me. That's probably not true, but it's pretty close. So I was asking Lauren, the ethicist, is there an example that you can think of where even a, like, my body, my choice, every case is likely to say, except for that case? Is there a thing? And he, of course, because he's a genius, was like, oh, yeah. And then he started telling me, can I share this? Because this made my head like, You know, like, so there is a thing, this is real, I'm not making this up, where there are people who believe they self-identify as amputees. So they would like medical intervention to align with how they identify and have their arm or their leg amputated. And based on current medical standards, that is considered doing harm because the appendage works, right? And it's in contrast of other people who have appendages that don't work. So somehow it is being medically ruled, I don't think this is the medical term, as a downgrade. So nobody will do it. So these people are chopping their arms and legs off themselves and probably dying from it. And most people would assume that you're not going to amputate a perfectly working limb to align with someone's identity. Okay, so then now we're back to sixth grade Jessica. When before trans-related surgeries were legal, trans women, especially trans women in prison, often amputated their testes themselves. Usually with a spork or a shank or something that they created in prison. And it was the number one cause of significant infection, if not death, of prisoners at the time who identified as trans women. Did they have the right to do that? Their body, their choice. Is it? So then now we're back to giving different values of what people's identities are and the value of life. They're in prison. Most people don't value trans women. They can do whatever they want to do. Who cares? They died. Well, one less of them. Nobody, well, that's not true. Somebody would say that out loud. A lot of people would not allow themselves to say that out loud because it would make them so uncomfortable that they even thought it, let alone said it out loud. But we value people differently. Can we just get comfortable with that and then be very discomfort? The amount of discomfort that comes from that being true, now we can do something about it.
Mm.
Very light podcast.
Yeah, but I mean, it makes your brain go, which was what I like. Again, being willing to walk down these roads and think the things and really be honest about it
have an answer, right? Like,
right.
I could blame this on being from Texas, but I don't think you should amputate a perfectly good working limb primarily because other people who don't have a working limb are have to deal with that.
And then the other side of that for me is if somebody is, this means so much to them that they're willing to do it with a spork. Part of me says, well, if we can provide them that in a healthy way so they don't get the infection, they don't die. Sure, they don't have an arm, but cool. If that's what you want and what makes you happy and what makes you healthy. And again, I don't know the answer either. These are the two sides that coexist, right?
Right. And we now provide trans or gender affirming care that is now generally considered legal. It is under attack, of course, but it at some point has been considered legal, and the other still is considered illegal. And somebody listening to this is like, I can't believe you drew a correlation between these two things. The point isn't the correlation. The point is that they are similar questions that sometimes we have emphatic answers about that we can't justify.
Mm-hmm.
And those, just like you said, coexist with, yeah, I don't know about that.
Right.
Can we just hang in that, though? Like, the beauty of studying patterns and hypocrisy is that the skill building is not the answer. The skill building is hanging with, I have an inconsistent pattern of very strong feelings and thoughts about this. I have no idea. And I go, like, rainbow, ball of death, blue screen, be inclusive. I have no idea what's happening. And, well, shit, I've never even thought about that. That is called actively using your own sense of responsibility. Get comfortable because it's getting ready to get very uncomfortable.
Yeah. She cheers. Well, now your book is called Good Enough Now. Right. And where does this fit into your inclusion message and kind of what we were talking about a second ago with coexisting with not just the people we like and do what we want to do or whatever? Where does Good Enough Now fit in? What is that?
Yeah, it's a cookbook. It's not related at all.
Oh, well, we're back to foods.
Yeah, but I'm kidding. So the tagline, is do the best you can with what you've got some of the time, largely because that's better than nothing never, right? It is an outrageously low bar that almost no one is willing to consistently do. Do the best you can with what you've got some of the time. So like in my keynotes or something, I almost always get some kind of pushback of how, what's the language that they use? How insignificant the examples are that I use. And what means significant? You know, so like there's a story I share about I was in a car accident deep inside COVID sheltering in place kind of stuff. I actually had just gotten a booster and my shingles shot the day before. I went and drove myself to the library to get a new book because I could feel whatever was about to happen coming. And on my way back from the library, a woman ran a stop sign. She was going about 80 miles an hour. She came to a stop, obviously. Three kids got out of the backseat of the car. No kid seats or car seats, those things. I don't have kids. No shoes. Walking around on broken glass all over the place. I am in a Fiat. Sure. And if it had been half a millisecond later, I would have been T-boned in a Fiat. But it hit the front bumper. It's fine. The airbag, I do recommend, if you've not been in a car wreck, I recommend airbags. Whole new world. So my car is totaled, airbags deployed. I am beyond fine. Everything is fine. It might not have been. But then I realize what's happening. And again, tells you about my neighborhood, a homeless guy opened my passenger door and started digging through my glove box. And I'm like, excuse me, sir. I'm preoccupied. Could you stop doing that? And he was convinced my car was on fire. So I think he was helping me and or seeing if I had anything good in the glove box. Got him out of my car. The force was so strong. I still don't understand how this happened physics-wise, but you're the one who watched Oppenheimer. But my keys separated, the ring separated from the key in the ignition. So my keys were in the passenger floorboard. Now it's a Fiat, so that's like 7 inches away, but still, they were separated. I get to choose who I'm going to be when I get out of that car. How insignificant is that? I was in a really bad car wreck when I was in second grade, really bad car wreck. And I am almost 50. P.S. If you're following along, I talked my way into the shingle shot before I turned 50 because I'm sassy. That car wreck changed my life. And there's a possibility I could have been the worst nightmare to one of those kids, a 30% chance that I could have changed that kid's life for the rest of his life. But I had a choice of how to show up. I don't think that's insignificant. And it goes back to what you were saying at the very beginning, is that I get to use these skills some of the time. And I get to pick and choose who I'm going to be. And I will never know the outcome of that.
And the impact.
All I'm asking is can I become slightly more conscious occasionally in those moments?
And it's exactly what we were talking about a minute ago with little steps. Little steps is better than no steps. It gets you there. So do the best you can with what you got some of the time.
Right.
Because and that's going to be the best you can do.
That's good enough, right? Now, I wouldn't employ this to like an orthopedic surgeon. And I tell that joke all the time when I speak to healthcare, and they'll come up to me afterwards and be like, no, it does apply. We're not allowed to say it. But like sometimes we can't get the entire tumor. So we get as much as we can. We could get more, but the quality of life of that person would be completely different. You know, like I remember this one guy was telling me he was haunted by this case. And he knows that he left enough of the tumor to kill this person. But he also knew that if he took it out, the person would not have hearing or eyesight for the rest of their life. So he chose, in the middle of surgery, without consulting anybody, what this person's quality of life is going to be for the rest of their life, which is going to be very short.
And how long the rest of their life is going to be. Yeah, exactly.
But what made the difference was the patient was 10.
Oh.
Right? So now, even in telling that story, people listening to this, what did you picture? You're responsible for what you pictured. There's no value judgment. You just pictured whatever you pictured. So this doctor had a 10-year-old kid and decided that this kid needed sight and hearing guaranteed in the short life they're about to have. The doctor shared this story with me because the kid lived until he was about 25.
Nice.
That doesn't mean he's right. The doctor was right. Telling me that this is how doctors get like God complexes.
Mm-hmm.
25 is still dying really young.
Yeah.
But right. He had eyesight and hearing the whole time. That is good enough. Don't tell an insurance company, but I mean, that is good enough, right? But who is he to say? The kid could still be alive and be deaf and blind, and there's nothing wrong with being deaf and blind, except we judge being deaf and blind as not being perfect.
Mm.
Who's able to judge who has the best quality of life? And at that moment, at that time, with that scalpel or whatever, that doctor had the ability to do it. Can we just be responsible for that?
Yeah. And just acknowledge it and acknowledge that there's no right or wrong answer. There's no good or bad answer. There's no, it just is what it is. And we, you know, I mean, and it's not, there's no, sometimes there's no good answer.
It just is.
Yeah.
No good answers, great answers, and unknown answers. Guess what? Coexist.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Mm. Well, JessPettit.com is the website. You can look a little bit more, dive in, give Jess a message. If you want to go deeper into this conversation or talk more about baloney, Jess is always fascinating, brilliant, and makes you think, which is something that I value very much. And again, as we just talked about over the last half hour, is pretty uncomfortable. So Jess, thank you for your time and your brain.
Well, you're welcome. And it's a lot easier to talk about these things than to actually begin to explain what baloney is made out of.
Yeah. And again, that's a whole nother podcast episode. I'll call Oscar Mayer, see if they've got somebody who wants to come on.
Possibly a sponsor. Good job.
Ooh, I think I'd rather have spam though. I don't even know how to end this. I hope that you're still listening. And if you are, thank you. And congratulations on being willing to stick with some uncomfortable topics. And we didn't even go that deep into it, into any of the things, but we went deep enough that it's uncomfortable, right? But it really makes you think, and it makes you realize that black and white views on the world coexist. There's no easy answers. There's no clear answers on things. And being able to dance in that discomfort and being able to embrace that uncertainty is truly why I created this podcast. There's differences. There's a discomfort. And that's life. So thank you for listening, everybody. I hope your 2024 is going well. And we will do some more amazing stuff here on Dancing in the Discomfort Zone podcast next week. My name is Ann Bonnie. If you want more information on me, go to AnnBonnie.com. You want more information on Jess, go to JessPettit.com. It's P-E-T-T-I-T-T, two T's. I've got a bunch of N's. There's a multiple consonant thing going on here. I'm going to stop talking now. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'll talk to you next week.